Welcome to Bickerstaff Bickering, a show about democracy, markets, and machines for people who believe
Not a
progress
lot of
needs
people, though.
principles.
There's a B. Dumb. Like, no, that's not even good. And then he's like, Democrats. I call them Democrats. It's like, okay, buddy. Like, little Marco, that was good, right?
Right.
Like, Sleepy Joe, that was.
Lion
That
Ted Cruz.
He used to have kind of a gift. But Democrats, like, no one really thought of that.
Right.
Right. And then, of course, he's still rambling about this ballroom. And anyway, so I think a great introduction is we start with a little quiz. How about that? You ready?
Okay. What is the quiz going to... I'm ready.
It's one question. Well, no, it's two questions. All right. What is the number one rule in cryptography?
Don't roll your own crypto.
What's the number two rule in cryptography?
Also, don't roll your own crypto.
So, our story today is going to be about someone who broke both rule one and rule two of cryptography.
Incidentally, also rules 3 through 10.
Right. So, look, if you're just starting to listen to us and you decide, I don't like their voices, I don't like how they talk, at least if you quit now, you know the first 10 rules of cryptography.
I mean, and these rules are in place for a very good reason, which is that cryptography is hard. And it's very much better if you rely on the work of serious people who have thought long and hard about these things and come up with the best implementation that a group of minds can manage and checked it and checked it again.
Like, even if you look at, you know, RSA, probably the most famous encryption scheme, is like, not only was it made by both R and S and A, it's also has been repeatedly checked and rechecked and analyzed and reanalyzed by an enormous body of people before it was put in a mission critical application, right? There were papers and conferences and presentations. So this is not something you should ever do by yourself.
These things don't get picked out of thin air. They go through standards bodies, and there's multi-year meetings and many evaluations by different government bodies. And
honestly, like, the best rule of thumb for crypto, aside from the first 10 rules, is just don't fuck with it. Or at least fuck with it as little as you possibly can. Because any change that you make is probably bad.
Right.
That's just, you're not going to improve on something. And if it's not working, your implementation is not working for you, then you don't take shortcuts, because as we'll see, those shortcuts can be catastrophic. So this is not like, oh, I had to disable a feature, and disabling this feature potentially makes it so that there's a, under certain conditions, there's a heap overflow. And, you know, this is not a normal sort of, one, like an RCE where they have to be able to connect to your thing on a network and they have to know it's there. I mean, those are dangerous enough. So if you're doing things like using unsafe when you shouldn't be using unsafe, well, really writing anything in C or C++ to a lesser degree, those things have a Those things have an even smaller blast radius than what we're going to talk about.
So yeah, let's at least get into the skeleton of the narrative here so that people know what we're talking about. So on, what is this, July 31st or something, 2026, people started noticing that Bitcoin tokens were leaving their wallets mysteriously and said, hey, that's weird. I used to have money here and now I don't. And it turned out all these people were customers of this product called Cold Card. In total, it affected, time of last research here, 4,585 people. That doesn't sound like a lot, but the dollar amounts of the Bitcoin value here is approaching $100 million. So certainly a decent-sized hack. And these are all basically random retail investors. This is not like institutional capital. These are people that probably got into Bitcoin early and have been holding it for a long time and thought they had a substantial fortune of Bitcoin and were keeping it safe with this hardware device that was sold to them by this company, CoinKite, and now they don't have that Bitcoin anymore. So that's the basic story.
I think one of the relevant things is, I'm not a Bitcoin person, but I did look a little bit into this Cold Card. And this thing was sold as, this is the ultimate vault. And it has all these little features that are supposed to make this thing impenetrable. It's supposed to be an air-gapped solution, which, yeah, I mean, the air gap worked. Turned out to not matter. But if you're buying this, you're buying this because you're really concerned about the security of your crypto funds.
Right. And one of the marketing claims that this company had relied on was that we only care about Bitcoin. All these other companies, they're trying to do everything all at once, and it distracts from the mission of protecting your Bitcoin. So we're going to focus exclusively on Bitcoin and just do that one thing right. And so they initially forked this other company who open sources their crypto. So yeah, they're mad at these companies like Trezor, whose code they forked, for supporting all of these shit coins in their parlance and not staying faithful to the Bitcoin-only mission. So they fork their crypto library, go off and make their own product, and they screwed up the implementation. So this is another part of the story here with crypto, is that the cryptography itself can function correctly, but then the way that you implement it is the problem. And basically, that's what happened here, is that they had a correct implementation sitting there in the code.
I'm going to argue, though, that that's not really a correct implementation. Though, they built a house and they followed the blueprint, but the foundation was made of just gravel, right? They just dumped a bunch of gravel and then they started building a house on it. I would argue that's not following the proper procedure for building a house. The foundation of cryptography is random numbers. And when you don't have random numbers, you don't have cryptography. In the same way, if your foundation is made of nothing but gravel, you don't have a house, at least not for very long.
Not for long, yeah. Yeah, maybe we should do a digression here into random numbers and why they're so important to cryptography. Because that is the bulk of this story, is they failed to properly produce random numbers. And the problem that you're faced when implementing a system like this is that computers are by nature deterministic. And that's most of the time exactly what we want. You want the same calculations to be produced when you run mathematical operations. That's all good. But then when it comes time to ask the computer, okay, make up a random number, in a lot of contexts, it's just kind of faking it. If you have a poker card game, or really a lot of games use something called, they call a pseudo random number, where it's kind of choosing a random value from a group, but if you know the initialization state of the function, you could guess what apparently random value it's going to select.
Yeah, generating random numbers in a computer, as Luke said, is very difficult. You can't do that very quickly and very easily. So generally, to generate a random number, you put a lot of effort into generating the first one. But if you have to generate a bunch of them quickly, that kind of falls apart. So what you end up doing is applying these various mathematical algorithms that make the output appear random, because every iteration of this algorithm produces a dramatically different output. A simple algorithm would be, okay, take the last number and add 3. If your starting number, which we call a seed, right? If your starting number is 100, well, the algorithm will spit out 103, 106. That's not very random. It's not even pseudo-random. But there are algorithms that make the output appear random because they do a bunch of mathematical operations. So one of these algorithms with a seed of 100 would produce 7,862, or 983, 42. And so those numbers appear as if they're being generated randomly. This is generally how large amounts of random numbers are generated.
Right. So if you're playing solitaire on your computer and the card deck needs to be shuffled, you can use a pseudo-random number and it's going to shuffle it in some way that is more random than the human mind can easily track, and that's suitable for making a game. All right. So we don't need strong randomness.
So there are analysts at agencies with 3-letter names who collect billions of these examples, and they try to reverse engineer them and go, this is the algorithm that produces these numbers. No one's going to do that for solitaire. And even if they do, which they won't, the risk is pretty low.
Yeah. I mean, cheating at solitaire is pretty sad, honestly. Like, yeah, you could probably crack it, but then when you get done and you're like, I can win at solitaire every time.
I've won, but at what cost?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So not a great place to spend your crypto cracking research. But where it does matter is when there's money or important data on the line, right? And then what you're fundamentally doing when you're generating a Bitcoin wallet is you're trying to create a random number in this giant space of numbers. I think something on the order of the number of atoms in the universe. Like, these numbers are very large. And so if you just pick a random one, you're vanishingly likely to select one that someone else has selected, like to the point where it's not even really sensible to contemplate if you get true randomness. Right. But if you don't get true randomness, then you can just pick the same numbers as other people. And again, that's basically what happened here, is that the randomness was weak enough that someone could guess at the much reduced pool of numbers and find private keys that had money attached to them and go, oh, I'll help myself to that. Thank you very much.
It's kind of like the lottery. If you got a pretty good idea what the winning numbers are going to be, then suddenly it starts to make sense to put in a little effort.
Right. Yeah, I think the standard odds for Powerball are something around 1 in 400 million. So if the pot goes over 400 million, then, you know, a ticket costs a dollar and it nets out mathematically to actually play. But this guy was able to, like, somehow find out the first 4 numbers or something. And so he's, right, you know, aiming at a target of like 1 in 40,000.
And suddenly he's going to every gas station in town going, I want all your lottery tickets because I'm just going to win, right?
So where does randomness come from then when you need strong randomness on a computer? One of the implementations I've seen of this that is just kind of a little bit silly and not the strongest randomness, but I think it helps illustrate the point, is there's programs that will allow you to wiggle your mouse inside the back of a little box on a screen. And the idea is that no two people are going to wiggle their mouse exactly the same, sort of like a fingerprint. You couldn't do it twice exactly the same way if you tried. And that's the randomness that the computer is provided with to initialize the algorithm. That's a way to think about it. Go ahead.
And that's one example. I mean, really what you should do, there are ways to generate numbers that are effectively random. They have a camera that analyzes this wall of lava lamps, and that is essentially random. I know there was another one where the company
Cloudflare, by the way.
Cloudflare, thank you. Where they sent like a bunch of these devices to the North Pole, and it was constantly detecting variations in wind. And because of where it is, this is like effective randomness. Now, there are people who would say, well, that's not really random because the state of the universe was determined at the moment of the Big Bang and all possible configurations. I mean, yeah, we can say maybe that's true, but also not really. Like, true randomness is possible.
Yeah, I don't want to get too deeply philosophical here, so I won't dispute that point.
I know you want to say, well, actually.
Well, you know, we could go into Laplace's demon, and but let's save that for another time. So yeah, each device, though, that needs to produce a random number, you need them to produce them independently. So with these cold cards we're supposed to do, they had firmware whose job it was to show up with some randomness or harvest some randomness for somewhere. And that is precisely what they failed at. Probably the most ubiquitous consumer device that produces randomness is the WebAuthn standard. Most laptops, pretty much all smartphones, they all have this secure enclave or trusted compute module. You've got an extra chip in most devices that its sole job really is to harvest randomness and produce keys and store those keys so that you can encrypt your data, you can authenticate. It's there to support all of those operations. And so cold cards sort of had this. But they didn't implement it correctly.
We're going back to the house analogy here. If you build on a sand lot, it doesn't matter what else you do. The house is going to collapse eventually. So I think it is interesting because what we have is, I think, a confluence of things. Because what drives someone to do what they did, we don't really know. But basically what happened was the compiler was complaining. This is a thing compilers do. This is a thing C compilers do. Look, if you've ever written any C or C++, you will know that the compiler hates you. It hates you.
Well, and specifically those compilers. So, not all compilers hate you, but specifically the C and
C++. Those compilers hate you, yes. I remember when I started writing Rust for the first time, and this was a revelation. This was like the heavens opened up, and God spoke to me and said,
"It doesn't have to be this bad.
The compiler doesn't have to hate you." So the C compiler does hate you. It hates you a lot. It hates you for being stupid and ugly, and it's just a malevolent creature. And so, as far as we can tell, the person who wrote the code that caused all this was sad because the compiler was telling them that they were stupid, and they didn't like that. And so they said, "No, compiler, you're stupid." And they commented out something that they should not have commented out. And this commenting out was the call to the enclave that generates the random number, or the pseudo-random number, the effectively random number. And they said, "You know what? No, this compiler is mean. I'm not going to put up with it." They said, "Shut up." And they probably shouldn't have done that. So the lesson here is sometimes the meanest people can make good points. And even though the C compiler hates your guts, you do sometimes have to listen to it.
Yeah, so the compiler is supposed to be there to tell you, well, A, it's supposed to compile your human readable code into machine bytecode that the computer can actually run.
That's a side effect of what compilers actually do, which is make you feel bad about yourself.
Right. Yeah. So it does that, but if you do something wrong where it can't turn your human readable code.
You're just like not entertaining my shit right now. You're like, right, yeah. Anyway.
We'll get to the part where it makes you feel bad again, but it's ideally it's supposed to tell you what's wrong with your code if it can't turn it into machine code, and point out, look, here's the thing you need to fix. But with the C compiler, it's so encrusted with decades of neckbeardery that it can't communicate with normal human beings anymore. It's like this, it can come across as this seemingly omniscient but malevolent god that simply chooses not to tell you what's wrong with your code, but to mock you instead.
Right.
And so, you know, when you're in first year computer science or whatever, and you're dealing with this for the first time, you're just like, I don't know what any of this means. I'm just going to change things until the angry messages go away.
That, you know, when you're doing a computer science project in college, that can work. Particularly because, so a lot of these errors are things that will only have downstream effects. They might be telling you that, oh, well, maybe you're not properly freeing memory, and so you're introducing a use after free. Or there's all these errors that you can introduce that it's possible no one will ever find.
Exactly. So you just change things until it goes away, and then you're like, okay, fine, it runs. Which is fine for, you know, your CompSci 101 class, but it's not good practice for production systems that many people's money relies on. And so the part that I am most confused by is that once he turns off the actual hardware randomness generator, that there's a second software randomness generator there to gently catch this mistake and cradle it in its arms and say, it's going to be okay. I've got your random numbers. But they're shitty random numbers. They're low quality random numbers now. So this is the problem, is that everything looks fine on the surface. You're still getting that minimum solitaire card shuffle grade randomness. But you're not getting the real thing anymore. And this is the real killer. Ideally, when you turn off the very important safety feature, the machine should refuse to run.
Right. And, you know, look, we've all certainly been in the situation where you're tired, it's the end of the day, you just want to go home, but then you don't commit to main, right? You take a step back and you go, all right, maybe there's a reason I shouldn't do this. There's a comment in the code that says, we don't need this. We're already implementing it, which is why we had our beginning of session quiz. Do you understand what actually this was meant by this?
This STM32 is the board, I guess, that is on the card that he's operating with, and that came with its own hardware RNG firmware code.
Okay, so it looks like one of the problems here was that the developer does appear to not have been super familiar with C and was actually using like a pseudo Python implementation of C, which, look, Python is a wonderful language. I love Python. I do a lot of things in Python. What I don't do is mission critical cryptography in Python. And anything that allows you to kind of bridge out of Python into another language is likely to have some gotchas. Python is a high-level language. It's very abstract. And so it looks like there was some misunderstanding as to how variables get assigned and that you can't simply assign a variable into another variable, and now they're the same thing. Python allows you to do that. C does not. And the compiler was complaining about this, and the developer said, no, shut up. I know what I'm doing, and this appears to be the core of the problem.
Right, this enable the random number generator variable was defined twice, and that's why the compiler was complaining.
Yes.
And so he just turned one of them off, but the wrong one.
Yes, that was the thing he did.
I guess it's a little like trying to defuse a bomb, and you're very confident that you're cutting the right cord, and then it's not the right cord.
So there's the hardware enable RNG is set to zero, which turns it off. And then he's trying to use the Python library random, which is not really a good idea.
Right. That's your pseudo random number generator territory. I will say that, like, there's computer people foot gun ourselves all the time by, like, usually when a process exits with code zero, that means successful. Any other number is the exit code and there's an error. But in this case, zero means off, one means on. You know, we're not consistent about these things all the time.
I'm going to stop you there because that's literally binary, brother.
Right, but does zero mean good or does zero mean bad? Does one mean off or does one mean on?
Correct, off.
But I think reasonable people could decide the opposite and just put it in the documentation that that's what it means. This is why you have to read the documentation, though, right?
No. Zero is always off, right? What are you trying to say? That zero is,
I mean, I was just pointing out that in some contexts, zero means success.
Okay.
And any other number means failure. And so, not necessarily true and false. Yeah, I mean, in any standard Boolean context.
So I'm going to set this to success. I'm going to set this library to success, and then I don't have to worry about it, right?
I'm just suggesting that it's possible to be confused about these things, and that's why you got to check again and again and again.
I mean, that's fair, but he also said he knew what he was doing because he said, we have our own implementation of this. So he turned it off, claiming that he didn't need their implementation. Did he misunderstand I mean, yeah, I think you could make the argument that he misunderstood. But it's not like he thought he was setting it to success, because he says in the commit, or sorry, in the comment, that we have our own implementation of this. So I'm inclined to think that this was just sloppy. You know, it's easy to point fingers, and we all make mistakes, but at the same time, I think there are some of us in software engineering who can say confidently, I would not have made this mistake in this kind of code, because I would have said, this is something very important, and so I'm going to make sure that I understand what's going on. To me, that's really the problem here, is that you have to understand when it's okay to be like, well, this isn't super important, and when it really is super important. And there just seemed to be a massive misunderstanding. I mean, even the commit message says runs. When you're talking about other people's money, the commit message of runs is not acceptable.
Yeah, I mean, so, don't let them see all of our commits, though.
Well, yeah. But what I'm saying is that this comes down to, like, what this comes down to is, as a software developer, you need to recognize when the bar is no longer runs.
Yeah.
There are times when that's not the bar. I remember you and I looking at, like, memory dumps, because this was like a critical piece of software, like this one little bit of software we were working on. And we felt this thing was so critical. We're like, well, what if there's a use after free in here? So let's look at the memory dump and go, did we zero it out?
Right. Can you still find the cryptographic material?
Right. Can you still find the material at all? Right. And if we didn't zero it out, then there's still a chance, and we need to make sure that we find a way to correct that. This is not what happened there, obviously. And this is like so many levels above that. In fact, you know what the stage is that could have caught this? The compiler.
It and, did catch it,
yeah,
but it didn't
right,
know what
it
was
what
saying,
saying
to it. Yeah.
And so another potential lesson here is, I know the compiler is an asshole, but you really shouldn't ignore.
There's another layer here too, which people have pointed out, which is that there's a difference between having build time guarantees and runtime guarantees. So when you build the software, you expect certain conditions to hold, and you say, okay, good, all these things are true, I can ship it into the real world. But then you can add extra checks while it's live in production. Every time the piece of software boots up, it checks itself to see if something is still true. And that is one of the things, as I understand it, we don't have full open source implementations of most of these trusted hardware modules on laptops and phones, but they are doing. So there's certain attacks, physical attacks. You can cool chips to enormously cold temperatures, and some of the randomness sources that they're harvesting will dampen. And so what they have the chips do is they test to see how random the values are. Am I getting true randomness from my random number generator right now? If not, again, throw the circuit breaker. We're not going. We're not attesting to shit. I don't know anything. Go away. And that's another thing he could have implemented.
You'll never make me talk. Sorry, that was my attempt at a gangster, and it was definitely very poor.
Yeah, so
what? Your reception.
What did not happen here?
Any sort of runtime check.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So no runtime checks. Fuck that. We'll just say, yeah, it looks pretty random at build and never test again.
Right. Which, again, that's the sort of thing where random at build, what does that even mean? Like, okay, I'm going to be philosophical here, but is the term random at build even, like, intelligible?
No. Well, you could say it looks like it'll produce random numbers.
I know. And I wasn't meaning to, like, I wasn't trying to gotcha. I'm just like, yeah, it doesn't really feel like that's even something you could do in that case.
Yeah, it's like popping the hood on a car and being like, I mean, it looks like it'll start. All the pieces seem to be there.
All the pieces are there. It looks right. And then you, like, I don't know, you pull out the dipstick and go, yeah, it's got oil on it. It's fine.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Yeah, it might be fine. But if the check engine light is on, you should still probably check.
Yeah, I mean, there's certain things that you can see at build time. If there is no carburetor, that's probably a problem. But you can't see everything.
Why are we talking about carburetors? What?
Like on a car, like what could you see that would tell you this isn't going to run just from the outside?
Cars don't have carburetors.
Really? I mean, I've driven an electric vehicle for a long time now. Maybe I've forgotten.
No, Grandpa. Yes. Cars haven't had carburetors since like the 80s. It's like, no, seriously. Like, when was the last car made with a carburetor?
In the early 90s. Electronic fuel injection.
Yes. Yeah. So the way, yes, there's fuel injectors. The intake valve opens. There's negative pressure in the cylinder because of the last cycle. So the air flows in to the cylinder. The fuel injector aerosolizes the fuel and injects it into the chamber. A spark plug ignites it. And then by that time, the cam is rotated. So, you know, the intake valves are closed, the explosion happens, and then the exhaust valves open, and the exhaust gas leaves. The 1994 Isuzu was the last one. So today we have learned.
They still have timing belts?
Yeah, some cars do.
Okay, you pick a car part that would be obviously missing.
Okay, so the valve cover would be like that would be the modern thing. So if you lift up the hood of a car and you're like, wow, there's no valve cover and the spark plugs are missing, you'd be like, this car is not going to run. But there are
I lift
a lot
up my
of
hood,
things.
It's like a Ken doll. There's nothing under there. It's just smooth.
That is going in.
All right. Anyway, so one more part of this story is that the reason that he was replacing this code at all was kind of petty spite. I mean, he'd taken this code from Trezor, borrowed it, shared it. You could say it was open source. It was there to be shared and made his own product off of it. And, you know, one of the things that companies that are trying to instill faith in their products that use cryptography try to do is they open source their code. They show everyone what it is. So, and when you take code that was open sourced, often the licensing associated with it says that you have to carry that licensing forward. So you can't build a proprietary product that no one can see using all these open source components. So he started getting worried that people were going to reuse his implementation of the code. And so he wanted to basically just change things so that the code was his own and he didn't have to obey the open source licensing anymore. And
so it's kind of like when your friend says, hey, can I copy your homework? And you're like, yeah, just, you know, change it around a little bit so that it doesn't look like you copy.
Right, but then you get some of the answers wrong if you're copying from your smart friend.
There's the rub. So this guy was trying to copy from the smart friend, and that just didn't work so good.
Yeah, he had to change a few of the answers so that the homework was really his own, and he got the wrong answers.
Yeah. There's a lot of life lessons in this, you know? I feel like we're at the end of one of those kids' TV shows. I don't know if they still do that, but what have we learned today, children? We've learned don't roll your own crypt, pay attention to the compiler, and don't trust that code that executes on run means that the code is good. That part I'm unclear of. We're gonna have to work on that lesson a little more. I'm still not entirely sure why running was considered sufficient for this.
So this calls to mind some cybersecurity experts like to mock the crypto world and just say it's never gonna work as in cryptocurrency. Computers can't be secure, can't be done. Humans are fallible. You're always going to make mistakes, and that's going to result in financial loss. And in the case of crypto, there's no reversing anything. So this is all just a bad idea. Don't even try. And I tend to believe that there is a way to make secure implementations of cryptocurrency products. But you can't underestimate the challenge.
Yes, I agree with you, but it does happen to be very hard.
Yes, which is why you really need decent-sized teams, serious people with actual experience working on these things. You can't just have ideologues working as hobby.
I mean, to my own horn here, I guess. But what you can't have is someone who doesn't have a serious background, or at least a serious interest in security, doing security. That's, I think, one of the problems that we've seen in crypto. I would make the argument that those problems kind of arise more because you have ideologues, certainly, or people who are interested in the finance portions of it, rather than people who are interested in security as such. Now, I realize I am a security engineer. I'm probably biased on this, but I think that's something that the crypto community really needs to start thinking about, is when can you stop relying on crypto believers, and when do you have to honestly start hiring serious people who think about security as their primary endeavor? They're like, oh, blockchain, cryptography, that stuff's all good, but then they fall short on the implementations because good security means analyzing all the attack vectors. As we can see, it doesn't matter if the cryptography's wrong if you didn't use the cryptography.
Yeah. Crypto is a strange subject because it attracts people that are interested in finance, people that are interested in ideological politics, and people who are interested in technology. And a subdiscipline of that is computer security. But really, yeah, I mean, that is the no-fail mission of crypto. If you're going to have these systems, it really has to be driven by, first, we can't lose all the money, and everything else
the
is secondary.
Is do not lose all the money. If you do lose all the money, then nothing else matters because you don't have any money to do crypto with.
Right. You can't accomplish any ideological or financial goals if you're just being robbed.
Right.
And what's funny about it is that he's very unlikely, I'm assuming it's a man, could be a woman, The attacker is very unlikely to be able
Let's
to
be realistic.
cash this out and go buy Lamborghinis and, you know, vacation in Thailand or whatever they're planning on doing, but because it will be traced and blacklisted and whatever exchanges will, you know, likely seize it. I mean, maybe they can get some of it out, but not probably the 100 million odd that they've stolen. And so, but on the flip side, people just do this stuff for the lulz, right?
That is true.
It's kind of irrelevant that they probably can't spend it all.
It's hard to say with complete sincerity that I wouldn't have done it for the lulz. I'd like to think I wouldn't have.
Yeah. And there are many such people who are willing to take these kind of risks for the lulz. And so even if it's not financially lucrative, you're still not safe, right? People will just ruin your day to ruin your day because there's 8 billion people on this planet and some of them are assholes. So there's not a way to really law enforcement your way out of these problems to where it's so unprofitable that people just stop doing it. Like, even if it's not profitable, I don't have any expectation that you're in the clear.
Yeah. I mean, that's absolutely true. The reality is,
your attack model has to include nihilism.
Right. All right. Well, that was our analysis. It's one of those things that I think you look at it and you go, wow, how could this have happened? It's hard to look at this and unravel all the little micro decisions that probably led to this. I don't know the guy who committed this coup. Don't know anything about him. I assume that there was some sort of reasoning going on. I don't know what it is. We probably never know what it is. But at the end of the day, this is just an implementation failure. Someone did something that breaks like three different cardinal rules of three separate disciplines. And they shouldn't have done that. And that's kind of all there is to it.
I can totally imagine doing it, but you have to wake up the next day after you're up late, coding, tired, look at your commit and go,
oh, man, fuck, what did I do?
Man, I should really give this a second look and a third look. And I should ask other people to look at it. And yeah, that's the part that's inexcusable. Never doing it in the first place. Probably impossible. Okay, fine. But it can't get to production like this.
That, to me, is the key point. You shouldn't make that mistake and then be like, oh, yeah, it's probably fine. That's the part that's inexcusable.
I guess I would just leave, you know, stepping off that last point that there are secure ways to do this. Maybe we'll get into this more in future episodes, but it's all about layered defense, compensating controls. You can't rely on just one thing. Like, you know, why do you have the runtime attestation? Because under certain conditions.
It's like defense, but not just regular defense. It's like multiple depths of defense. It's kind of like maybe defense in depth.
Yes, that's
Sorry,
what I'm
that
saying.
That was a security joke. If you don't get it, that's fine. And actually, you're probably better.
So this is to say, you don't need to give up hope on self-custody crypto. But how to tell which products are better than others is tricky as a layman. If you don't understand the code, then you do have to at some point trust someone to do things right. And you're looking for track record, you're looking for they're using trusted components. That part is a challenge, and there are good implementations. This was not one of them.
There you have it. There are good implementations. This was not one of them.
That's it for this Bickerstaff BickFest. The folly continues. but reason endures. Until next time.